This is a Please Explain podcast extra. I'm Tori Maguire. Adele Ferguson's reporting on the banking sector played a key role in forcing the government to announce the Hayne Royal Commission. In an exclusive interview for our listeners, she tells our business editor Matt Dunkley about the book she's written on her investigation into the financial sector, the role of the Royal Commission, and what it means for Australia.
Welcome, Adele.
Thank you, Matt.
Now, I really enjoyed this book. It was terrific. Smashed through it, and I am a slow reader. One of the things that I really liked was that it was clear that as you went through the process of writing the book, you came across things that were surprising and that were new to you. And right from the outset, you lay out the scene of how we ended up in this terrible mess with the Royal Commission. And one of its central characters in the telling is Wacker Williams, the senator. I loved that you found out new things about his story. And it's very, very illustrative to set the whole book up. Can you tell me a little bit about that surprise that you found out along the way there?
Yeah, so I had written about banking scandals for a number of years. When I decided to do the book, I thought, where did it begin? How did this start? So I remember ringing up John Williams, telling him I'd just read this book called Banks Are Bastards by a former senator, Paul McLean. And he said, I know him really well. He helped me when I was a victim of Commonwealth Bank. And I kind of knew, you know, in the dark, you know, valves of my mind that he had been a victim of Combank.
Yeah, it was a bit folklore, wasn't it, explaining why he was.
It was, but I didn't know what it was about. So I was doing all of this research on financial deregulation, how the banks had this new lease on life. They were free to do everything, but there was no regulator, really. It was just starved of resources. So I rang up Wacker and he says, yeah, let me tell you my story. I was a farmer, there was a drought on, and I couldn't pay my bills. So I go to Inverell, local CBA branch, you know, tie, shirt on, wanted to get the loan, $220,000. He comes out with a $640,000 Swiss franc loan. What they tell him is nothing can go wrong with this. The interest rate is a third of the interest rate of the normal bog standard loan. Take this and prosper. 2 weeks later, the currency turned and that loan was now $1.5 million. So he spent years battling the bank, ended up in a $2,000 caravan, lost everything, broke up with his wife. Absolutely devastating story. So he became really the emblematic of what can go wrong when people are sold shonky products.
And you managed to track down the bank manager, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And he said that he didn't know what he was selling. He just had to sell these products. And when Wacker had rang him and said, can I hedge it? He said, no, you're not allowed to do that. So the loan just went into free fall. It just kept on blowing out and out and out.
So that really set the scene, didn't it? This whole moment in the 1990s and in the post stock market collapse zone, that really set the frame for the whole next couple of decades, didn't it?
It did.
What were some of the things, the building blocks? And we'll get to the Royal Commission in a second, but I think this is really important, this backgrounding. We really laid the foundations for this house we ended up with, didn't we, back
yeah,
then?
Yeah, absolutely. So we had, you know, to start with, we had a weak regulator. They ended up setting up a regulator called the Australian Securities Commission. It was well-resourced, but it was more caveat emptor, which is buyer beware. And it was very soft-touch regulation. And that was the start of there was no consequences for the banks. So they could really do what they want, and there was not a lot of consequence. You add that to lobby groups who are becoming much more powerful. Anytime there is a scandal, there are recommendations made for a code of conduct or whatever, the lobby groups come in like a swat of locusts and obliterate it. And then you have the politicians who don't want to, you know, upset the apple cart. So they're not going to do anything legislative wise. And it just goes on and on and on. So there are no consequences. And you have the share market that is just pushing the banks to make more and more profit so that the share price goes up so everybody looks good. And the ones who are missing out are the customers. They're the ones that are the cannon fodder for dodgy advice.
One of the things that turbocharged that environment was this new emphasis on selling, right, from the banks. And the name of the model was the Cohen-Brown model, wasn't it? The,
yes.
Now, you managed to track down one of the people behind that. Tell us a little bit about his theory and where he says it actually went wrong here.
Yeah, so Marty Cohen. So a lot of people that I spoke to who were part of the whole banking system and the wealth management section where you had this aggressive sales, talk about this American sales where you're just flogging products, turned out to be Cohen Brown. And I tracked down Marty Cohen, who was, his argument was that his model was fantastic and it just helped encourage bank tellers, financial advisors to cross-sell.
Because they're given scripts and things, aren't they? The words are put in their mouths.
They
were.
They had telephone scripts. So if you're ringing up to get something, they will be flogging 10 different products and will not let you go, and they'll keep on hounding you and hounding you. What he reckons the difference was, it stopped there with that. The banks and the wealth managers started adding targets and bonuses to it. So that's where the boiler room culture came into effect.
So coming on a decade, 15 years of this boiler room culture being entrenched in our banks and being forced down customers' throats, tell me, what was it in about 2013 that really got you going and started you off on your trail that eventually led to this Royal Commission?
It was a phone call from Wacker Williams to say he'd heard from a Commonwealth Bank whistleblower who had documents and the most incredible story to tell about what was going on in the financial advice division of Commonwealth Bank. So I rang up the whistleblower, who was Jeff Morris, who everybody knows Jeff Morris now, and he told me about forgery, fraud, cover-up, and more importantly, a regulator that was missing in action, ASIC. He'd gone there, he'd actually ended up knocking on the door, and it had taken them 16 months to do anything. And when they did, they'd given CBA the heads up they were about to raid in 2 weeks, so everybody's getting rid of all of the evidence. It was crazy. And that's where it began. So the story came out in The Age and The Herald. It was a front page story, and I never experienced anything like it. My email just went crazy. We got hundreds and hundreds of emails with leads. It was the biggest clicked story for the week. It was really amazing. And it was people, it was like the Me Too movement, really. It was people identifying with, hey, I thought I was just stupid, or it was the GFC why I'd lost all my money. I didn't realise it was actually the bank and financial advisors that were putting me into products that were inappropriate. So it went crazy, and then other whistleblowers from other banks came along, and it just had a cascade effect.
That's right, and the legacy of work then, the litany of scandals you broke out, we had Timbercorp with ANZ, we had NAB a couple of times, there was CommonSure with Commonwealth Bank. One of the wonderful things about your book is you bring home what the practice of trying to get those stories together was like. It was really amazing, and I had a pretty good seat for a lot of that, but some of it even I didn't know. One of the things that stuck with me was the tactics that the banks would use, particularly targeting the people who were speaking out. Tell us a couple of those examples because they're amazing.
Yeah, so it is. Smear campaigns against whistleblowers, against victims, against myself. One of the standouts was James Kessel. He was a customer of CommonSure, life insurance arm of CommBank. He had a heart attack and he applied for his policy and got knocked back because the definition was a decade out of date, so he could never claim it. And he went away. He had no money. We tracked him down in Wee War in this little tin shed and told him what had gone on. The story's ready to come out on Four Corners because it's been advertised. It was in the newspapers at the weekend, but there's ads for the Four Corners. And John Williams rings me up. He'd had a call from a spin doctor at Commonwealth Bank saying, hey, you know that guy that they're advertising on Four Corners, James Kessel? He's a shonk. He's faked his heart attack. His brother's faked his heart attack. And the sister-in-law faked her heart attacks. They're a bunch of fraudsters. So I said to John, just watch the show because we interviewed the cardiologist who brought him back to life.
Because he'd had defibrillator panels applied to his chest, hadn't he?
He did. Yeah. He died. He was gone. And when he got the knockback from the life insurer, he went away. He never tried to take legal action or anything. And his brother had actually died of a heart attack. He had a disease that the family didn't know about. So again, another fake heart attack. But it just shows you the lengths they go to try and diminish or undermine people in a story.
There's the other one that stuck in my mind was the case with the IOOF whistleblower, which you relayed in there. IOOF being one of the biggest financial institutions in the country, managing many billions of dollars.
Yeah, over $160 billion in funds under management.
So when they were confronted with whistleblower testimony through you, tell us about their response.
Oh, this one was actually a doozy. It was a very senior person at IOOF, not a spin doctor, but a very senior official, wrote me a letter initially to say, your whistleblower is a fake. He's a schizophrenic. He has tried to blackmail and kidnap the kids of people who work at IOOF. He's tried to extort money out of us, etc. It just went on and on and on. I met with this person and he didn't have anything. I said, where are the emails? I don't have them. Where's the proof he's a schizophrenic? Oh, it was just something somebody had said. Where is the proof that he extorted money? Oh, it was just another something that I'd heard. It was all completely untrue, but again, it was designed to undermine him. And I had got phone calls at my desk from anonymous people saying, oh, you know that whistleblower, he's really dodgy. He was just a sweet guy who wanted to blow the lid on really bad wrongdoing going on at IOOF.
So we built up quite a story around the banks over the course of what you did. You built up quite a story around the conduct of the banks over several years, an incredible body of work, and eventually it became clear we were going to get a Royal Commission. How did you find out about that key moment, and what was that like? How'd that feel?
Well, I knew it was about to happen because there were moves afoot with some of the backbenchers of the National Party. So it was just about, towards the end, it was just a matter of time. But then the morning of, I got a phone call from Bill Shorten, who was the opposition leader at the time, to congratulate me and to say what was about to happen. And also Wacker Williams had been tipped off and he said they're about to announce a Royal Commission. I'll never forget the moment. It was just an amazing moment that all that work, all that crap that we'd all gone through, the time had finally arrived and Australians had been heard. They had wanted one for so long and they were now getting what they really needed.
It was tempered a little bit, wasn't it? Almost immediately, as soon as you saw the terms of reference. What was your first impression when you saw what was actually going to take place in the name of Royal Commission?
I was disappointed. I thought, you know, be lucky we got what we got, but it was disappointing that it was only going to be 12 months. It was a budget of $70 million. The terms of reference were wide but narrow, in a sense. Wide in the sense that they threw in superannuation, which is a $2.8 trillion industry, and to put such a huge sector in was just going to diminish everything else. You really needed something separate for such a big industry in itself. So in that sense, it was so broad. How could they possibly cover everything in such a short space of time? And narrow in the sense that you couldn't have anything that was in the courts, that sort of thing. So it meant bank bill swap rates, AUSTRAC, a lot of stuff that was really critical could not be even discussed.
Having said that, there must have been some moments that stuck in your mind. We'll get to overall assessment of the Royal Commission in a moment. But when you were going in there, there was definitely some real moments of great drama and theatre and importance that cut through. What for you were the big moments in the Royal Commission?
There were so many moments. Having said that, you know, it was 12 months of incredible moments throughout that time. Some of the most important to me was the Commonsure. So the insurance round, it was life insurance. It was Helen Troop who runs CBA's Commonsure division. I felt really vindicated listening to the Royal Commission grill Helen Troop and some of the antics that had gone on. It was sheer vindication. I remember yeah, Dr. Ko was SMSing me at the time, also feeling vindicated because they were referring to an audit he'd done of heart attacks.
Dr. Ko being the whistleblower in the Common Shaw case.
Yes, that's right.
And there'd already been a couple of investigations by this point, hadn't they?
There had. So the corporate regulator, ASIC, had launched an investigation. So had CommBank. They had got, I think it was Deloitte, to do one. They were both real whitewashers. I remember reading them thinking, this is incredible. You know, the CBA one was a 12-month investigation. It was about 12 pages and it was so superficial. And they were basically got off scot-free with just a little slap on the wrist. You listen to the Royal Commission and it was vindication. It was sheer vindication.
What about the round? For me, I think one of the most powerful rounds was the watching the CEOs and the chairman. Now, I had to do it remotely, but you got, I think, pretty well a front row seat. What was that experience like? Do you think that was one of the best moments for the whole inquiry?
Yes, I do. It was, you were seeing CEOs and chairs who are normally surrounded by their peers or sycophants. They don't ever get to get questioned, hardly ever. You know, they might at an AGM have a couple of shareholders that might ask an awkward question, but this is 3 hours or more of sheer attack. Questioning, probing, documents. It was really good to see that, just to make them, they squirmed and they had to mea culpa and they had to be made to see the wrong things that had happened in their institution.
There was a good moment, wasn't there, when didn't you get a message again from Dr. Ko during, I think it was Matt Commons' evidence?
Yeah, so Matt Commons, the CEO of Commonwealth Bank, he was talking about a product, CCI, Consumer Credit Insurance, which is where if you take out a credit card, you can take insurance. So if you get sick or you're dying, it can cover your credit card bills. But the product was a dud. It was designed that a lot of people could never claim on it. So he had gone to, at the time, the chief executive, Ian Narev, to say, this is a shonky product. You know, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people are being sold this product. We should stop. And the advice from Ian Narev was temper your sense of justice. And that was in 2015. And he did. He did nothing. He didn't go to the board. He didn't go anywhere. He just sat on it and kept selling the product. And he ended up becoming CEO. Dr. Ko, the whistleblower, sent me a text saying, Matt Common tempered his sense of justice and now he's the CEO. I didn't temper my sense of justice when I saw wrongdoing in the life insurance division and I lost my job.
CommBank ended up ditching that insurance about 2 weeks before the hearing or something, didn't they?
They did, yes. I think it was even less than 2 weeks. It was about a week before the hearing because they knew it was going to come up.
And there was a great counterpoint anecdote in your chapter in the book on this. And that's one of the great things of the book is you've got constant references to real people, the genuine victims and people who are touched by this stuff. So tell us about what you did. I think it was after Catherine Livingston, was it the chairman of Commonwealth Bank?
Yeah, so Catherine Livingston was there with her Order of Australia badge on, her pearls, getting eviscerated at the Royal Commission. And it was hard for her to explain exactly how bad the bank had been. It just didn't seem to permeate for her. Afterwards, we went to, I caught up with a woman called Tasha Keys, who was a victim of the bank and had a terrible time with them. And I interviewed her and then we went to dinner with Jeff Morris, the CBA whistleblower, and there were about 12 other victims of banks there. And it was the most extraordinary time because each of them came and sat next to me for 10 minutes to tell their story. Some of them had tried to kill themselves. Some of them had lost everything. It was just heart-wrenching. So it was a real contrast between listening to these people who have made so much money and, you know, sat in silence watching all of the misconduct that's gone on and then seeing for yourself in person these terrible things that have happened.
And that was one of the shortcomings, I think, in your reckoning and the end analysis of the Royal Commission, isn't it? That there weren't enough of those stories of the people who are actually affected. How many case studies did they do in the end?
27 case studies, people who went on the stand to have a cathartic moment of telling their story. There were over 10,000 submissions. So there were a lot of very disappointed people.
that was some of the classics, weren't they, as well? There was the nurse at the start. There was the man whose son with Down syndrome had been sold insurance. Yeah. Those were some of the most telling and important moments of the whole inquiry, weren't they?
That's right, because you can relate to them, because you're listening to them, you're hearing them. It's very hard to relate when you don't know who these people are.
And so what's your scorecard then? What do you think, where do you think we ended up 12 months or so after it started, and we're now 6 months down the track after its final report? Where do you think we ended up?
It was great to have a Royal Commission to put the spotlight on the industry and to see some of the rampant systemic misconduct on an institutionalised basis, criminal conduct. The problem was it didn't go far enough. The final report did not go far enough. It didn't go into the structural conflicts, which was a real problem. But then if you fast forward to today, the government still hasn't legislated for any of the recommendations that were made. So we're still waiting.
We haven't seen much even draft legislation, have we?
No, nothing as yet. When the government was re-elected, the share prices of the big four banks and AMP went up about $30 billion in the first couple of days, which kind of said, is this a taste of things to come?
What about the regulators? Do you get a sense that we're seeing anything different from them?
The regulators were really lambasted throughout the Royal Commission. They came up short. I always knew ASIC was a very weak, timid regulator. We'd heard that so many times before. APRA really surprised me because it was missing in action. It was the see no evil, hear no evil regulator that was way too cosy, as was ASIC. ASIC is now talking tough. Every other day we get a press release about what it's doing. Let's hope that that actually translates into something and that they have learned the lessons that they're not there to be friends with these institutions. They're there to regulate them and make sure they're doing the right thing. APRA, I'm not so sure about. If you looked at very recently, a capability review came out into APRA. It was scathing of it with a series of recommendations. The chair, Wayne Byers, didn't seem to have a strong appetite to take up some of those recommendations, even though he said he would. He was then qualifying it.
So you're not the only one who's a bit disappointed about what we've ended up with out of the Royal Commission, despite the excoriation that the banks received. You've been in touch with a whistleblower, as we've seen in recent days, from NAB. Tell us how that came about.
So I've been in touch with this whistleblower over the years, and then after the Royal Commission had finished and just before the final report had come out, I was contacted by the whistleblower again with a trove of thousands of pages of documents, which is dynamite. And it really got, one of the issues he had was the conflicts between auditors and
the banks.
And the consultants. Because the auditors, the big four auditors, KPMG, Ernst & Young, Deloitte, etc., they all do consulting work as well. And it's a big issue with conflicts because they're making tens of millions of dollars a year out of these institutions.
For audit work?
For audit work and consulting. The UK is clamping down. The former regulator here, Greg Medcraft, as he was leaving, was saying this is a very big issue. We could end up with the next Enron if we're not careful about keeping this in check. It was never covered at the Royal Commission. We had a little taste of it with AMP and Clayton Utz, the lack of independence. These documents show that there are really questions about conflicts and independence. It goes into a lot of documents. There are minutes of interviews with the likes of Andrew Thorburn, who was the CEO of NAB, the chairman, Ken Henry, and dozens of other executives at NAB. There's also a logbook of Ernst & Young's private musings about what it really thinks. And then there are stacks of documents looking at the risk ratings of NAB, which, quite frankly, is horrifying.
And this process was all being undertaken. This is what staggered me. It was being undertaken in the middle of the Royal Commission.
It was.
So they engineered a process where they were going to assess NAB, ask them what they think on behalf of the regulator, mind you, to send to them, right? And even in the middle of a Royal Commission with all of that going on, they were prepared to sort of duck away from the reality of what's going on in the bank. Is that fair, do you think?
I think that's essentially what was going on. They used sanitised language to play down the seriousness of some of the things. And you can see that in the contrast between the log that they use of their own confidential wording versus the draft report that's to go to the regulator. And then if you look at some of the minutes of what has been said by, you know, the chair, that isn't in this report that's going to the regulator. Why not?
That's right. He told EY, didn't he, that they're selling things they will have to compensate customers for.
In the future.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah. So why are they still selling them? And B, why haven't they remediated them already?
Told the regulator.
And yeah, C, told the regulator.
So I suppose it boils down to, do you think that we're in the clear? Do you think the banks have taken their medicine, that the politicians have got the message, that the regulators are finally going to bare some teeth? Are we out the other side, and can you now go and write about something else?
Unfortunately not. I think I'll be writing about this for quite a while yet, when we're certainly not there yet. We've got no legislation in place, no draft legislation to show things are going to change. It's just talk at the moment by the regulators. Let's see some proper action. Let's see some heads on sticks. Until then, it's just all talk and rhetoric.
Well, Adele, thank you very much. As your editor, I very much look forward to seeing some more writing from you on the topic. It's a tremendous book and a great credit to the body of work you've put together.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
That was Senior Business Reporter Adele Ferguson talking to Business Editor Matt Dunkley. Since this episode of Please Explain was recorded, the federal government has released legislation taking up some of the Hayne Royal Commission's recommendations on insurance and fees for financial planners. Her book, Banking Bad, is available to pre-order and hits shelves on August 5. Keep an eye on your feed for our regular program this week, and as always, thanks for listening.